We started out looking at the covenants in the Old Testament, this big idea of covenants. We looked at just three of the many covenants that are described in the Old Testament. We looked at God's covenant with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It was the covenant that began in Genesis 12 and was reiterated on a number of different occasions. And then we looked at the covenant with Moses and Israel that was made at Horeb. And then the covenant that was made, that was at that covenant, which was added to at Moab. This is the Ten Commandments law. It's the all the statutes and ordinances that Moses got. Remember, he went up on the mountain. He received the Ten Commandments. He came down. The people said, yes, we want to do that. He went back up on the mountain. He got the statutes and ordinances. And then the people said that they wanted to do that. Then there was the Davidic covenant that God made with David when he told him he couldn't build the tabernacle, or couldn't build the temple, excuse me, but that his son Solomon would build it. And then that covenant has an ultimate fulfillment in what Jesus did. So when we think of covenant in the Old Testament, Ephesians 2 reminds us that there are covenants of promise. So when we talk about covenant, we have to be sure that we know which one of those covenants we're talking about. There's some important ideas in chapter 7. The priesthood is changed. There's a change in the law. That's chapter 7 at verse 12. Then verses 18 and 19, there's a disannulling of a foregoing commandment. Because of its weakness and unprofitableness, the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw nigh unto God did. And then the big idea from chapter 7, verses 16, and then after he makes a break, he comes back to it in verses 20 through 22. This is the law of a carnal commandment. It was with an oath, but it points out that Jesus' oath was better. So Jesus becomes the better covenant, or mediates the better covenant. Now in chapter 8, he starts out with the chief point that he's been trying to make is, we have a high priest who sat down on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. He is the minister of the sanctuary, the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. So this was the conclusion of everything he'd been saying in chapter 7. Then the next idea that he presents to us is that Jesus offered both gifts and sacrifices. We spent a little bit of time talking about the distinction that exists between gifts and sacrifices. In the Old Testament, typically, sacrifices have reference to something related to sin. Gifts, on the other hand, were offerings that were made to God just because of who God is. They're a sign of our respect to God. And in that sense, it is like what Abraham gave to Melchizedek. That was a gift. It was an offering, but it was a gift. It was a tithe. And the tithe was something that was given to God in the Old Testament period. It didn't relate to sin. It was because of who God was and what he had done. We talked a little bit about copies and shadows. And Jesus, of course, is the real thing. The Old Testament pointed to him. He's the mediator of a better covenant, enacted on better promises. And we looked at some of those promises that are a part of the better covenant. It was for all nations, not just for the descendants of Abraham. It was for all nations. It was a covenant of peace, not a covenant of war. War was a part of the Old Testament covenant. It's not a part of the New Testament. That's why Jesus could say, I'm a king, but my kingdom is not of this world. If it was of this world, my servants would fight. Then the better promise relating to sin is that it removes sin. It completely takes it out of the way. Not like the promise regarding sin in the old covenant, which was, you'll still be a sinner, but I'll roll or I will not remember sin for 1 year. So sin is remembered every year in the old covenant. If the old covenant had been faultless, there would no place be sought for the second. But the fault lie not in the inability of the old covenant to do what it was supposed to do, but the fault was with the people who were a part of that covenant. Wasn't a fault with the covenant. And the reason I know that is, he says, for finding fault with them. He says, I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah. We talked a little bit about Israel and Judah and the distinction between the two. The reason that he makes this new covenant, not like the covenant that he made when he brought them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, they continued not in that covenant. I regarded them not. And we talked about how a new covenant can be new in terms of time when it's made, or it can be new in terms of kind. And this new covenant is new in both of those senses. This is the covenant that I'll make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I'll put my laws into their mind, and into their heart will I write them. The old law was a law of carnal commandments. This is a law, this new covenant relates to the mind. And it's a statement that's made on a number of different occasions. Now, there are a couple of other characteristics that I want to get into tonight that he says are a part of this new covenant. In verse 11, he says, in this new covenant, they shall not teach every man his fellow citizen and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for all shall know me. How did you get into the covenant that Moses gave? What made you a part of that covenant?
You were a blood relation to that bloodline through Abraham, through Moses.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. You're born into it. That's how you got into that covenant relationship. And if you're born into it, you have to be taught what the covenant says. So you're in it, and then you're taught what it is. That applies only to the old covenant. Isaiah 54, verse 13. Can somebody read that for us?
I have it.
Okay.
54:13.
Yeah.
All your sons will be taught by the Lord, and great will be your children's peace.
Okay. So this is something that's said about this new covenant. They're going to be taught by the Lord. They will be taught, but it won't be teaching to people that are a part of the covenant. They are taught before they come into the new covenant. That's the difference. They'll still be taught. Look at John 6, verses 44 and 45. Can somebody read that?
No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, and they shall all be taught of God. Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me.
Okay. So it's the difference is in the way that you get to be a part of the covenant. Old Testament, you're in the covenant, and then you're taught about what it says. New covenant, you're taught about what it says, and then you come into that covenant. So it's a matter of agreement to keep that covenant. I have often thought about people that were born into that old covenant. And, you know, you think, well, why is this? Why am I required to do what the covenant requires? Why am I required to keep the Sabbath? Why am I required to make sacrifices that are required for sin? And the answer to that is, you were born into it. You don't have a choice. How did my kids become Cruises? They were born that way. How did Dash, who is adopted into the Kryle family, become a Kryle? His parents wanted him to be a part of their family. And you know, when he went to court, the judge asked him, is this what you want to do? He could have, at that point, said no. I don't know what would have happened if he had said no. I don't want to be a part of this family. I suppose the adoption would have been stopped. But the judge did ask him, do you want to be a part of this covenant, this family? That's the beauty of the new covenant. Nobody is required to keep that covenant unless they've agreed to keep that covenant. Comments.
Of course, the other side of that is no one gets access to what the covenant offers as a reward unless they do agree to keep the covenant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just like when Moses put it to the people at Mount Horeb, do you agree to do what God is asking you to do? And they all said, yes, we agree. But generations after them were bound by that covenant, even though the generations that came after them never gave assent. In the new covenant, everybody gives their own assent of their own free will to those things that God has taught them are going to be a part of the covenant. So nobody gets into it, this is not the right word for it, by accident. Nobody's born into it. And that was a big part of the restoration process that we talked about when we talked about restoration history. The whole question was, what do we do with children who are born to people who have rejected the covenant? Must we reject them? Now, remember, the kind of culture that they lived in, you couldn't vote in the colonies unless you were a member in good standing of the church that was in that colony. Unless you had a covenant relationship, you couldn't vote. And they didn't know what to do with people whose parents had rejected the covenant and then wanted to vote. That's not something that we have to worry about. And for one, I'm glad that I get to decide whether I personally want to be a part of this covenant or not. Any other comment? Yeah, go ahead.
This might sound like a dumb question, but when we obey the covenant, are we making a covenant also? Or are we just obeying the covenant?
We are giving assent. We're essentially saying to God, I want to be a part of this covenant.
Right. But he made the covenant.
Well, so you can say that the covenant had two sides. When we talk about a covenant or a contract, typically we talk about a contract that exists between two equals. You know, I can agree to buy something from you and I'm your equal. You can agree to sell it to me because you're my equal. So you agree to sell it, I agree to buy it, but it's an agreement between equals. In the case of God, we're just certainly not equal. God's bringing all the blessings to the table, and all I'm doing is saying, yes, I want to be a part of the covenant. I accept the claims that you're making on my life.
Okay, I'm obeying it then. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But I didn't think that was the same as me making the covenant. So that's okay.
Well,
I think it is. I mean, we're in covenant with God. We agree to that part of the contract. It doesn't mean that we bring anything to the table necessarily. But because all of the blessings come from God, but I think it's more than simple obedience or difficult obedience. It's more than just obedience. It's we are in a covenant relationship with God. We are a part of that covenant.
Okay. I always thought that, but when you said God made the covenant with Abraham, how did you say that?
Well,
God made the covenant. Abraham didn't make it.
Yeah, in the case of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12, remember, there were no conditions associated with that. God said to Abraham, I will make you a great nation. At that point, Abraham had not done anything to warrant his, there was no obedience at that point. Now, later, you could argue that there was obedience on Abraham's part. But Genesis 12, when God said to Abraham, get up, go into a far country that you don't know anything about, that I'll give you and I'll make you a great nation.
Okay. I just wanted to get that straight in my pea brain here.
Yeah, that was one where God just made the promise. And Abraham didn't accepted or rejected. Abraham was kind of along for the ride.
Okay. Thank you.
Good question, though, Eileen. So when we talk about the new covenant and the old covenant passing away, you have to remember what covenant we're talking about. Okay. Then he says, this is verse 12, I will be merciful to their iniquities, their sins will I remember no more. And that's a big deal to the descendants of Abraham, because the best that they could hope for was God saying, under the old covenant, their sins will I not remember until the next day of atonement. And then verse 13, when he says a new covenant, he had made the first old. that which is becoming old and waxeth aged is nigh unto vanishing away. It's that old covenant is going away. Now, what covenant was he talking about that was going away?
The law of Moses, wasn't he?
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. Now, understand this. Who was accountable to the law of Moses?
Only Jews.
What were the rest of the people accountable to? If you were a Gentile, what were you accountable to?
No law, because you were a Gentile. You didn't belong to that family.
That's true. And as far as that law is concerned, you had no relationship to it.
But we still had to obey God. Didn't they still have to obey God?
The natural, what you called the Adam's law?
That's what I call Edenic law or Adamic law or a moral code, Eden law. However you want to describe it, God had expectations for them. Now, the interesting thing is, God never said those expectations went away. What's right and what's wrong, that really doesn't change. So people today who don't know anything about the new covenant, they're not answerable to the new covenant, they haven't agreed to it. What makes them a sinner?
God's natural law.
The Edenic law. That's still here. What was taken out of the way was the law given to Moses. And for Jews, this is important, and this is a Jewish book. But for me, I become a sinner not because I haven't been baptized. That's not what makes me a sinner. I'm a sinner because I violated the moral law, moral code, Edenic law, Adam's law, however you want to describe it. That's what makes me a sinner. I'm not going to drown because I'm not in the boat. I'm going to drown because I'm in the water. The boat is what'll rescue me. But it didn't put me in the water. That's not what made me a sinner. That's a really important point. Who kept the Sabbath?
The Jews
did. Was anybody else held accountable for not keeping the Sabbath? No. And the Jews took advantage of that. What they would do is they said, well, we can't work on the Sabbath, so we'll hire Gentiles to come in and run our business. They missed the point of the Sabbath completely. Even though what they did was not what the Gentiles did working on the Sabbath was not violating the law. Okay. And we need to keep in mind that the Old Testament is called an everlasting covenant, but what that means is that it's going to last until the end of the age. Not that it's going to last forever. This new covenant is going to last until the end of this age. And after this age, I don't know what the covenant is going to look like. It will be heaven. Does God have expectations even in heaven? Well, I think he does. But it won't be like this one. Won't be the same as what we have now. Okay. Well, Ted, I told you I would try to get done in 10 minutes. I didn't make it.
It's all good. I think what I have that I was going to cover tonight, I expected to only have about 20 minutes. So you gave me an extra 10. So it's all good.
Okay.
What we are going to look at tonight is just the first 10 verses of chapter 9. So let me get my slides up here. Hold on just a second.
I'll stop sharing here as soon as I get to it. Okay.
All right. There we go. All right. So this lesson tonight dovetails perfectly into what we just discussed. So we've been looking at the covenant. We've been looking at chapter 8, which was a discussion of how Jesus is a better high priest. Jesus is a better high priest. And now we're going to look at why Jesus' ministry is superior because it is in a better sanctuary. So chapter 9 is going to talk about the first 10 verses tonight. We're going to look at the old tabernacle. We're going to look at how it was imperfect and that its services were imperfect. And then next week, we're going to finish the rest of the chapter, which shows us how Jesus is in a better sanctuary. His sanctuary is far superior to what was set up in the old covenant. So the old tabernacle and its services were not perfect. It starts in chapter 9 and verse 1 saying, "Now even the first covenant had regulations for divine worship and the earthly sanctuary." And what we're going to look at tonight is just a closer look at what that sanctuary looked like. So this first, when we look at chapter 9 and verse 1, when it says, "Now even the first covenant," that word covenant, if you look in your Bible, is in italics, just like it is in verse 7 in chapter 8. The word covenant is not in the original. The original says just the first. We supply the word covenant because the context of what we're looking at tells us we're talking about a covenant relationship. And so it's easier for us to understand it, but just remember that word covenant isn't really there, but that's what we're talking about, is the covenant. The same noun that's supplied in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 7 is supplied here in verse 9, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the covenant. Some of the older translations actually put the word tabernacle there instead of covenant in this particular verse, because that's what we're talking about here now.
the first tabernacle. And you'll notice that the writer here specifically talks about the tabernacle. He uses the original tabernacle that was given in Exodus. He doesn't talk about the tabernacles that followed. He does not talk about the temples. He talks about that original covenant tabernacle that was given with the giving of the law. So this covenant or tabernacle had regulations for divine worship. And these regulations we've talked about over the past several weeks, they can be found throughout the Old Testament, but especially in Exodus chapter 25 and 26. But I want you to look at that word had. It is past tense. It had regulations for divine worship because that covenant is no longer in force. That tabernacle is no longer used. It has been replaced by a more perfect covenant, by a more perfect or better tabernacle. The method of worship was completely organized by the Lord. And again, we can read about that in Exodus 25 and 26. It was not left up to human invention, and it did not just evolve. God gave very specific instructions for how worship was to occur, for what was supposed to happen, for what the priests were supposed to do, how they were supposed to do it, when they were supposed to do it. We talked about in chapter 7 how Jesus was a better high priest because the old priests kept dying. They could only serve for a certain amount of time, from a specific age to a specific age. And that those priests had specific regulations they had to follow. And Jesus is better because his priesthood is eternal. His priesthood is forever, to the end of the age, as we've discussed. What will our covenant look like once we are in heaven? No clue. I do not know. God did not give us that. He has not revealed that to us. But you can be guaranteed that whatever covenant we are under in heaven, God will put forth to us, and we will have the choice to agree or not to agree, just as we did here. But as I noted, if you choose not to agree, there will be consequences. He goes on to say, and the earthly sanctuary, the Lord also gave very specific instructions as to the entire structure of the tabernacle and all of its contents. It is called the earthly sanctuary because it was not intended to be permanent. It was material, it was temporal, it was perishable, made by human hands. I mean, we're going to look at the construction of the tabernacle here in just a minute. This tabernacle made of wood, coated in gold, covered in fabric. Does that sound permanent to you? Not to me. It was never intended to be permanent. It was intended to be perishable. It was how God had decided he was going to instruct his people to look forward to something better. The earthly tabernacle is nothing close to the quality of where Jesus now functions as our high priest and mediator. The earthly tabernacle is a poor shadow of that true tabernacle where Jesus is now. So verses 2 through 5 give us an overview of the tabernacle, its design, and its equipment. Starting in verse 2, for a tabernacle was equipped, the outer sanctuary, in which were the lampstand, the table, and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle, which is called the most holy place, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, Aaron's staff, which budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory, overshadowing the atoning cover. But about these things, we cannot speak in detail. And he's not going to go into a lot of detail about that. But we're going to look a little bit more detail because we have the benefit of looking backward and seeing what that looked like. So the courtyard measured 150 feet long, 75 feet wide. It was surrounded by a movable cloth fence hung on posts that were 7.5 feet high. The entrance to the courtyard was made of a curtain hung on 4 posts. It was on the east side. It always faced the east, that entrance into the tabernacle. Inside the courtyard, on the eastern half, stood the altar of burnt offering and the laver. And inside the courtyard, in the western half, was where the smaller structure, which was 45 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 15 feet high, composed of 2 rooms, the holy place and the most holy place. It's where that tent was pitched. And this is just a picture out of an old book that I got off the internet. We've seen this picture probably many times. And the description of all of the articles of sacrifice and worship inside not only the most holy place and the Holy of Holies, but also in the courtyard itself where all of those sacrifices took place. Verses 2 and 3 discuss the smaller structure where the holy place and the Holy of Holies reside. And verses 3 through 5 detail the equipment that were inside the structure. And so the dimensions of the first room were 30 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 15 feet high. The outer walls were made of boards 15 feet long and 2.3 feet wide, with 2 tenons in the bottom of the boards that stood in sockets of silver. And once upright, the boards were butted up against each other, side by side, and held together with 5 bars or poles run through golden rings on the boards. The boards were overlaid with gold. 10 sheets of cloth made of blue, white, scarlet, and purple linen with needlework cherubs on them were spread over the erected boards and make a ceiling for both of those rooms. The outside was then covered with waterproof materials to protect the furniture from the elements. And again, this is just another picture from that same book, which shows us those things that we probably have seen many times before. The tabernacle that God had given instruction for building and erecting whenever they were moving. And even when they came into the promised land, they used this tabernacle. This is where they would sacrifice. This is how they would keep the covenant. They would follow the instructions given on those tablets and in given to Moses, which Moses relayed to the people. So the equipment of the holy place all served very specific purposes. The lampstand was the only light in the tent. And so that tent was not open all the time. It was closed. And so the only light that was in there was from this lampstand. The table upon which the sacred bread was placed, along with all of the ascribed gold dishes and vessels used by the priests for doing their various duties in that holy place. And then the altar of incense. And we'll discuss later the translation issue we have with this altar in this particular translation, which is the New American Standard. The altar of incense was actually in the holy place, not in the most holy place. The coals from the altar of incense would be taken in a censer into the most holy place, and then incense would be poured on those coals, which would cause a fog, which would cover the mercy seat, because if the priest were to look upon the mercy seat, it would kill him. And so the point being that all of these regulations, all of these things that the people had to do, were specifically laid out by the Lord. The most holy place housed items only the high priest could interact with. So behind that second veil, the room was divided by a veil, making the second room just a smaller cube, 15 feet by 15 feet by 15 feet. And in that room was the Ark of the Covenant, with a golden jar of manna in it, Aaron's rod which budded, and the stone tablets that Moses brought down from the Mount Horeb. From Mount Sinai, sorry. The verse that we're reading here said, and above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the atoning cover. And then he says, but about these things, we're not going to speak in much detail. I've given you much more detail than he did, just so you can remember what we're talking about. This ornate, very well described and executed tabernacle, which God gave them very specific instructions for. This was a shadow of the tabernacle where Jesus is now. That is heaven. This is a shadow of that perfect place. He goes on in verse 6 to say, in chapter 9 and verse 6, now when these things had been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing divine worship, but into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he himself offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. So we're going to look at a few things here. So the priests were in the courtyard and in the holy place. They were doing daily incense burning, both morning and evening during prayer time. And the lamps on the lampstand had their oil replenished morning and evening. The sacred bread was changed out weekly. So what he's talking about here is the priests performing their divine worship. But in that second place, yearly, on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would enter the most holy place. But this isn't just the high priest going into the holy place. This was a elaborate thing that had to happen. He had to have different clothing that he had to wear. He had to offer an offering for himself. He had to offer an offering for the people. He had to then, once he had done that, he could go into the most holy place. But like I said, pouring incense on the censer that had coals from the altar of incense to cause a fog that would cover that mercy seat so that he wouldn't die by looking upon it. There was a very elaborate thing they had to do. Once he did that, he'd come back out, he'd change his clothes. Then he had another offering he had to do of rams. And then he had to change his clothes again. And then he had another offering he had to do of the scapegoat, which was one goat he would offer on the altar, the other goat he would touch with his hands, and it would take the sins of the people out into the wilderness until the next Day of Atonement. And that goat would die in the wilderness. But what we're seeing here is that he did this to offer sacrifice for the sins of the people. But I want to look at something specific. It's for the sins committed in ignorance. These are sins that the people didn't mean to do, that they accidentally did, that they didn't. This isn't you making a choice to commit sin that we do. We make a choice to do something sinful. Through Jesus' blood, we have forgiveness. These people did not. The sins of ignorance were forgiven by this Day of Atonement. Sins of choice were a death sentence. But this day did not forgive sins. It rolled them over to the next year, where they had to offer it again. Not until Jesus' blood was offered do we have forgiveness of sins. So the people were doing this with the understanding that the blood of bulls and goats cannot forgive sin. That no matter what ritual they did, no matter what sacrifice they offered, their sins could not be forgiven. God would overlook their sins and require this Day of Atonement on an annual basis. But it is not until Jesus offers himself on the cross that we have forgiveness of sins. And that blood flowed backwards for these people and forward for us. That is the only way we have that forgiveness. He goes on in verse 8 to say, the Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food, drink, and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until a time of reformation. So the Holy Spirit was teaching a lesson throughout the Mosaic Age. There was no open access to God. The way to the throne room was barred for all men, even the high priest himself. We can pray to God through Jesus Christ, asking for forgiveness of our sins. That was not an option for the people. They didn't have that mediator. They did not have that forgiving blood. They did not have access, direct access to God. Not even the high priest did. It wasn't there. While the tabernacle stood, men had no direct access to God for forgiveness of sins. The sacrifices and rituals could not and did not remove sin. And that's what he says in verse 9. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices which are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience. They understood that. But I think that a lot of these people who were born into this Mosaic law and are looking backwards as Christians and saying, you know, it's really hard to be a Christian. All these people who are dying and all the sacrifice, all of the things we're going through to be a Christian, it's just not worth it. I'd rather just go back to doing what I was doing before. And when you look back on the Mosaic law and all of the things they were required to do with the understanding that it did not remove sin, we can see why the writer spent so much time reminding these people of what they were doing or what they had been doing before they became Christians. Reminding them of the priesthood. Reminding them of the tabernacle. Reminding them of all of those sacrifices and rituals and washings that they would have to do in the law of Moses. And then pointing out each and every time that it was to no avail, that the law could not forgive sin, but Jesus could. So he spends the first 10 verses here in Hebrews chapter 9 talking about that, about the original tabernacle, about what it looked like, about the purpose it served. He's going to spend the rest of Hebrews chapter 9 talking about where Jesus is now and what he is doing for us now. And we'll look at that next week. That's the heavenly tabernacle and the superior services that Jesus can give for us in heaven.